Five, four, three, two, one, zero. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Johannes Torpy is a well-known Danish designer who, among many other things he has done, for example, was the creative director at Bang & Olufsen and once had a space-themed nightclub called NASA. He is passionate about what he calls domesticating space, bringing space closer to people at large, beyond our existing community. We met at Spacecom in Orlando earlier this year and finally had a chance to schedule a podcast episode to talk about all this. Enjoy.
My name is Raphael Rotkin, and I'm an investor and advisor to space companies. Just as a reminder, this podcast is for informational purposes only, and nothing should be taken as investment advice. This podcast is sponsored by NanoAvionics, a satellite manufacturer and mission integrator. Their technologies enable many space companies worldwide to offer services that improve life right here on Earth, such as providing global connectivity, conducting Earth observation, or contributing to scientific discoveries. Check them out, and also check out my episode with the CEO and co-founder. Sadly, I am not a rocket scientist, but I'm an alumnus of the International Space University. ISU offers a number of educational programs about space worldwide. Check them out at isunet.edu.
And just some final things before we start the episode about ourselves. If you enjoy the podcast, please leave us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, such as Apple or Spotify. If you want us help expand our work, you can do so and support us at www.patreon.com/spacebusinesspodcast. And we'll also put that link in the episode notes. And lastly, you can follow us on Twitter at podcast_space.
Hey, welcome back, space enthusiasts. We are here back with another episode, and it is one of our arguably non-business episodes, or at least not purely about business. Longtime listeners know that every few episodes, even I get bored just talking about business with entrepreneurs, even though, of course, that is very exciting. And I need to talk to other exciting people who have a connection to the space ecosystem, like astronauts or artists and designers, which is the case of today's guest, Johannes Torpy. Welcome, Johannes.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here and happy to get this great introduction, which I think fits pretty well into the bracket of non-space, but pretty spacey at the same time.
Oh yeah, we're raising expectations here. Johannes, if you don't mind, could you just give us a few minutes introduction of who you are, what you've been up to, what you've been doing, what excites you?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, also as a broader perspective, you could say I'm Danish, as you can probably hear in my accent is called Denglish. So we try our best, but it will always be recognized. Sometimes they think we're German, but we are not. We are, or Dutch, but we are Danish. Denmark is the small country, you know, in Scandinavia, which is very clean and very happy. And I grew up here, and I did my first businesses as well in this country. Actually started very early at age 15 with a lighting design company, and went from there into doing graphic design, and then I did nightclubs, and from there I did music. I have a big music career. I actually did a couple of world hits and been touring around the world. And when I became old enough to realize that being 50 and playing in front of 50,000 teenagers on drugs was not my future perspective, I focused more on my other career, which is design and architecture. And that actually is what brought me to be interested in the space industry, because the space industry by default is a very engineering driven industry. And you know, even as a kid, I dreamt about space. When I was 5 years old, I watched Stanley Kubrick's Space Odyssey for the first time. And when I watched that, I knew that I wanted to do something with design and something with space. So it was kind of like a coming together, you know, working with the space industry would be super exciting. And meanwhile, all that, I also, you know, had a couple of other interesting positions. I was chief creative officer for Bang & Olufsen, which is a Danish audio, a video brand of super luxurious products that many people know and fewer people own because it's highly expensive. But nevertheless, it's been a super interesting journey to do all this and understanding both sides of the business, both, you know, being a consultant, being an architect and a designer, helping people solve complex programs and problems. And then on the other hand, sitting in a big corporation on the other side and receiving, you know, suggestions of design and solving it and creating it. So I've tried quite a lot of things in my life. And that's why, you know, working with the space industry is something that is of deep interest to me. And we are doing pretty well in actually getting in to work with some big organizations. So I think that is exciting. I think maybe that was like a long introduction, but now you've got an idea of where I come from, at least.
No, thank you very much. Thank you very much for that. I mean, maybe first of all, you did mention in the middle there, you are, your career as a successful career as a musician, and this is an audio podcast, so people can't see, but you are actually in the middle of a recording studio surrounded by tons and tons of percussion equipment. And, you know, yeah. I love drawing. Do you mind giving us a quick drum roll for the rest, as an intro for the rest of the podcast?
I think if you make a joke, I can make the drum roll. Make a joke. Come on, you can do it.
Okay, space joke. Okay, yeah. I'm going to steal one from a friend. Okay, why did the moon stop eating?
I don't know.
Because it's full.
Aha! Yeah, you got roll. It. The drum roll. Drum rolls are very important in life. And, you know, it's not the same as saying, if you actually have drums in front of you, why not use them?
Yeah. Okay. Okay, coming up, I don't know how to follow on from this. That's very cool. But in any event, I do know, because, you know, I've looked in preparation, of course, as I always do, at some of the things that, you know, have been publishing, or some of the things published about you. And I found a few years ago, you were giving a keynote, as you do often, at a big design event, I think. And you entered
Design
the room,
Inaba.
Not just Design Inaba, yeah, I think that's what it was. And you entered, you didn't just walk onto the stage as sort of like, you know, losers like I do when they give keynotes. You floated into the room, suspended from the ceiling, wearing a golden space suit. What was the thinking there?
Well, the thinking was that arranger of that event, which is amazing, called Design Indaba in Cape Town, South Africa. Ravi, he's a super nice guy, and he said, Johannes, I don't want another boring design keynote where people, you know, stand on stage and they're showing their work and blah 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 blah. People applause. I wanted a performance, and, you know, as my my business for many years have been performance, but, you know, going on stages and actually performing. So I thought, you know, okay, you know, if you give me the opportunity, and it's a theater, so you have equipment, I'm going to make you a complete rundown down per second what I want to do. And I did so, like a total plan, which included like a fly rig harness from movie sets. So I could actually fly through the room and land on stage and go down in a space pit, stage pit. So, you know, you enter at a certain point on the stage, and there is a hole, and you fly down the hole. And so what happened actually is that we play the theme of a space odyssey, you know, and I fly in the golden spacesuit, and then I start to speak to HAL 9000, like, you know, we have a problem, Dave, you know, this the conversation from a space odyssey. Have the conversation, and then I fly down, and I go into the hole in stage, and down there, I remove the golden spacesuit I'm wearing, and the fly harness from the movie set, and then I rise up on a platform and walk out on stage. So the kind of entrance on a stage in a design world that kind of split the audience, one half loves it and the other half think you are an asshole, right? And I think that was a very funny thing to enter. And then apart from that, you know, I also played one of my hits on stage with a singer and dancers and DJ and everything. So it was kind of like telling a story about where you started as a child. And the story is that when I was 5 years old, I watched a space odyssey. I dreamt about space. And that kind of made me realize that I wanted to work with the space industry in some capacity, with whatever I could do with design. And that, you know, five-year-old boy, you know, when you're a small kid, you kind of create this narrative for yourself, these dreams. And I always thought when I was a child, if I had any problems, you know, I could wear my golden spacesuit. It was kind of like something I thought always. If I was wearing that golden spacesuit, it would protect me from the world. And that's a story I'm telling in that keynote, that you have to remember what brought you to become who you are. It's not always your parents. They have a certain part of the trajectory of your life, but it's also yourself, you know, what you envision at a very early age. And I envisioned that I would do something with space and design, and I would create stuff, and the golden spacesuit would protect me. So it's kind of an analogy of the childhood dream, and which I think is super important in everything we do. And I just told my story there. And I generally find keynotes to be, you know, with exceptions of few, pretty boring. It was pretty much like people presenting their work and they don't give very much of themselves. And I choose always to do that. I like to tell a personal story when I go on stage because I think I owe people to give something of myself. Then it's up to them if they, you know, want to receive it, right? If you get my point.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this sort of like, let's call it like, it's also channeling the inner child, right? And staying connected to that. And
yeah,
sort of, like you said, your heritage makes you drive. But so I think this is, and you probably agree, this is not only you, right? There's something, when we talk about space, this is, it seems to be something almost universal and visceral, right? Like, and how many people are there when you ask them like, okay, what did you dream about as a child? And there's, we consider it stereotypical, but many of them would answer, oh, I want to be an astronaut, right?
Yeah.
And it's not just a generation. It's not just a generation that grew up around like us that actually grew up sort of at the very back end, I guess, of Apollo and golden age of space exploration.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's also people after that. And so, and that's fascinating. So you have something like almost universal that connects us. And now I think you and I are among the people who think that space is really going through a sort of renaissance again, and we may be
for sure
about to have another golden age. How can we sort of work with this base that we have, that it is, space is such a universal, visceral thing, and now connect people to what's going on in space, right? Because yes, it is universal and visceral, but on the other side, of course, it is, as I think you mentioned a few minutes ago at some point, it is sort of like, you know, really high tech. It is literally the proverbial rocket science. It can scare people off.
Yeah.
You don't know what's going on. You especially, and it's not only you don't know what's going on a technological level, it's also some of the things are now happening so quickly that you just don't know what's going on in general. It's like, wait a minute, people are talking about settling Mars. Like, what the hell is happening?
Yeah,
how can we work with what people have and sort of use things like you're doing, dramatic entries, but also like design, architecture, all of this, the arts, to connect people to what's going on?
Yeah, but it's a super interesting thing because, you know, it's quite some years ago, I think it was 2015, I did my first space industry talk, and that was at the conference called ISPCS in New Mexico, Las Cruces, at the Farm and Ranch Museum. It was the most random thing, but it was pretty lovely to go there and meet all these people that I speak often with today. Frank Culbertson being one of them, the great astronaut. And when I went there, you know, there was like this public press conference where, you know, taxpayers, citizens could go and ask questions to the space industry people. There was like outside in a big tent, and there was like this panel, and then, you know, taxpayers came and get free beer and ask questions, which was interesting. And I went there, I was there early. So I went out and I sat down, and I consider myself knowing a lot about space. And this panel was sitting there. And then the first question, you know, any questions from the audience? Yes. A guy, he stands up and he said, "Hi, my name is Bill. I'm a local citizen here from Las Cruces, New Mexico. And I would like to ask you guys, what are we using our taxpayer money? Why are we going to space? Why are we going to space? You know, it's a good question. Why are we going to space?" And then one of the guys was standing up, and I think it was Bill from Virgin Galactic at that time, the chief medical officer. And he was standing up. So, well, this is a good question. Well, the reason why we're going to space is because of science. And there I realized what he was saying was nonsense. It didn't make any sense unless you are in the space industry, unless you are a medical or a science professional, you will understand the reasoning he put to this, you know, citizen, this taxpayer. And he was completely confused. I was also confused. And I was like, oh my God, I actually don't know anything about what this guy is talking about. And there I realized at that space conference, because I wanted to go there and talk about design and why design and architecture is important for humanity and for people and so on. So if I'm going to do a conference, you know, like a keynote about design, the whole audience at this conference are not going to understand what I'm saying. So I have to change my keynote very quickly in a few hours and make it into domesticating space instead, into talking about to the space industry professionals why what they are saying makes no sense if you are not from the industry. And if they want to expand to people of, you know, citizens of the world and, you know, actually get people on board to the space industry, they need to speak a language that we understand. And I know a lot, but I felt, you know, totally behind. You need to speak a language that people understand, and you need to create a narrative of where citizens of the world can come closer to the industry. Otherwise, you leave them behind. And then it's only going to be STEM educated people who have a future in the space industry. And with the goal of 8 million more employees in 15 to 20 years to join the space industry, that's not going to be achievable. It's going to be impossible unless you start opening up and being way more open to people. And that's what I realized. So I did a new keynote where I talked about that instead. And the whole room was like, yes, thank you. You're right. We are doing terribly in communicating. Please help us. What can we do to this? So I basically had all the people, not all of them, but most of the room afterwards coming, let's talk, let's do something together. But it's very difficult for the space industry because it is driven by, you know, engineers and the STEM educated people, defense, aerospace, and, you know, to speak in a more layman's language is very, very difficult. And the only way you can do it is actually to get people closer by being more inclusive and being more open and creating experiences that can be open to the audience and to the world, right? And that's what we are working on with Space Foundation in Colorado Springs, for instance, to actually create this big experience center where people can come together and experience not only what does it mean to be an astronaut, because that's going to be very few people, but what does it mean to work in the space industry, and what can a non-STEM educated person help to create the future of space? Does it make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. And actually, I love the whole the term you used in the middle about, you know, domesticating space. And
yeah,
so I agree, sort of like if we have on one extreme, like, you know, we throw an average person into, I don't know, like an MIT aeronautics, astronautics course, that is definitely not domesticated. That's like the wild, like tiger, lion, whatever.
I normally, I will call it like a wolf, right? So a wolf looks like a German shepherd, but it certainly is not a German shepherd. But the German shepherd is a domesticated version of the wolf. So it's like space is the wolf.
It's funny you mentioned that, because my next sort of like facetious question was like, okay, we're talking about domesticating and hence pets. Do you think space is more like a dog or a cat?
Well, I mean, space is definitely a cat. It's not something that when you say, come over here, it's not going to run over to you and lick your hand. A cat is going to be more like lying and looking at you. It's like, what do you want? You know, and that space is like is something that you really have to want to go to. And you know, in my naive mindset, also being non-STEM educated, I feel that actually, long story short, I'm actually non-educated. I went 3 years to school my whole life, so you know, I don't have a high school diploma, or I haven't been to university. So everything I've done is always done by creating a new business and doing that and learning from that, right? So that's also why maybe when you have a different kind of mindset, you're not limited to what you should do based on your education. So to me, the whole world is open. I can do everything. And that's why I can also work with the space industry and help, you know, creating a new narrative and get people, maybe not like myself, but people who are not necessarily highly educated to be joining the space industry and really doing something brand new, creating the new narrative.
Yeah. And so let's stick with this topic of domesticating space, because I find it fascinating. I agree, it's really important at this point in time.
Yeah.
For many reasons, including reasons you already alluded to, that we need to drag many more people into the space sector as workforce, as entrepreneurs, as investors, and so forth. Many more than we have right now, because otherwise we'll have bottlenecks, which we're actually frankly already starting to experience.
Oh, yes.
So I'm just going to throw out some examples of, like, you know, potential ways of connecting space with let's say everyone, non-STEM, normal, whatever you want to call them, people, like non-nerds or something. I'd be curious to hear sort of your opinion. And you know, I apologize if some stuff may seem sort of like very utopian or something.
Fine.
Okay, let's start with, I really apologize for that because it's so stereotypical, but you're Danish. So, you know, like I have like several Lego sets of, like, you know, Saturn V rocket and space station. And what do you think about these things, sort of like, you know, bringing literally space into people's homes via play, because it is play.
I mean, that's where it starts. I mean, my 2.5-year-old daughter, she is obsessed with rocket ship. And that comes from, you know, the cartoon series called Super Simple Songs. And it's a song's like, we're going to a rocket ship, we're going to the moon, dun 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 dun, and then just like a countdown. It's like 3, 2, 1, rocket ship. Wah! So she is absolutely everything she talks about is rocket ship or dinosaurs, right? And it starts with play. And I like it, the question a lot, because, you know, that's also how I started. I started also playing. I got like a scale model of I think Saturn V rocket, it must have been. And that made me play with that one. I also destroyed it, I think, at a pretty young age. But it kind of already there, it gives you this feeling of doing something extraordinary. And then it was the space shuttle at a young age also. I had like this poster where it was like a cut through of the space shuttle on my wall. That kind of playfulness with that Lego did, you know, there were some of the first companies that actually did like a space theme. And I know one of the guys who was the designer of the space project, a good friend of mine called Bjarke. And he said that, you know, in the beginning, they didn't know if it would succeed. It was not affiliated with NASA or any way. It was just like their own space, you know, thing. But very quickly, they could see that the kids love something technical they can build. So I think there is a direct link to the more we can create something that is space themed for kids to start playing with, the more we get them interested in both in STEM education, which would be the larger goal of educating people nicely, but also in imagining new stuff. And that's why I think Lego did the right thing. And I think the best start if you want people interested in space is by play. Playing is like what, you know, is the foundation of a human being to become, right?
Agreed. And so for me, sort of potential extension of play, so the sort of next thing I ask you your opinion on as a mechanism of connecting space to everyday people, is you mentioned experiences. And so one way of experience, again, may seem sort of very trivial or cute, is like theme park type things.
Yeah.
And I actually noticed that, you know, I'm a relatively big Disney fan, and you know, the first Disney park, Disneyland, that was opened sort of around the beginnings of the first golden age of space, right? And Walt Disney made a conscious choice, if people know the Disney parks, that divided into various what they call lands, right? And one land is called Tomorrowland.
Yeah.
And it's all like futuristic, and you have some rocket themed things there. And of course you have what's called Space Mountain, which has a roller coaster inside, right? And of course then what happened is Disney has never renovated this since basically the beginning of the parks. And these days it looks completely like something like really cute and retro. But back in the day, that was arguably state of the art, and it was trying to bring closer what's happening to the people back then. What do you think of something like that?
You know, what I think is really funny about that is that it's the sad experience. You know, I've been to Kennedy Space Center numerous times, and I also actually spoke at the Kennedy Space Center for the engineers, like in the big auditorium, and talk about this, and which was super interesting, because also when you visit the exhibitions there, the problem is that space is actually very retro. So nobody talks about the future. They all talk about the achievements, and the achievements are, of course, absolutely unbelievable. What has been achieved from the very early days of the space programs and the shuttle program and so on. But nowhere in those facilities where there is experience to be, heaven for kids and grown-ups, is there anything about the future? Or extremely little. It's mostly like, oh, here's the space shuttle. You know, you come in the space shuttle and there's like a 3D projection on it and so on. And then you leave by there. So this is what we have achieved. It's not about this is what we're going to achieve in the future. And I feel that there's an enormous potential in bringing the future of space closer to the future generations, and nobody's doing it. We are working with Space Foundation to do it in their Colorado Springs site, and there's no doubt it's a great idea. But I'm wondering why we can't do the same thing, you know, where actually there's launches in Florida, for instance, where you have like all the opportunities to do it. And it's something we are very interested in working with, and we are, you know, trying to find the right partners to do it. And another thing is, like, when you go to any of the space conferences, it is kind of the same thing. You have a lot of people talking about the achievements, and you have a lot of astronauts who obviously are the ones who actually have experienced space, where most of us have not. But again, it's very much talk about payloads and the rocket technology and the systems and the flight, and but it's not so visionary when it comes to talk about the future. And I miss that element of future thinking that Walt Disney actually did when he, with his theme parks. Right now, there is no experience like that. You still, it's still like a walk down memory lane. And I think there's something there that we can build a brand new narrative of the space industry too, because we need people to be involved. Otherwise, again, it's like a bunch of nerds talking about nerdy stuff, right?
Yeah, I so agree with you. I'm trying to remember who said that, but I think it was a famous explorer, and he said something like, if you want to, maybe you remember, if you want to get people to build a boat, you don't tell them exactly how to cut the wood. You like make them dream of the sea, right?
Yeah.
And I feel like right now that every event is basically talking about, you know, how to build a boat. And that's clearly very important, right? But we're missing some of the make them dream of the sea or the moon or the Mars or the universe.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and what's happening right now is that you know, the tech billionaires of the world will take over in the same way as they've done. I mean, Elon has done with the automotive industry. It's just making not necessarily a greater car, but just a smarter car, right? And not necessarily a better spaceship, but just a, you know, smarter spaceship that can be reused and so on and so on. And for the future generations to have place in this, we need to inspire them. And if you don't inspire them by getting them closer to the industry, we are kind of missing out. And I think there's something, there's a enormous potential in, you know, one thing is achieving going to the moon and from there to Mars. You know, that's one thing. Most people of our lifetime will not experience commercial space tourism. I mean, probably not, right? But what we could do is to build something in proximity to where those rocket launches are and create experiences that give them, you know, chilling experiences that will make them feel like they are going to space or they are going closer to space. And so to me, it's not so important to make like 3D printed houses on the moon as other architects would like to do. I'd much rather build moon space structures on Earth, because this is where most people will experience it. And that's where we can build a trajectory for space in the future. It's actually on Earth.
But what do you have in mind here? Is it sort of like, is it like a theme park or like a hotel or like a other type of hospitality, like, you know, like a restaurant, like, again, coming back to Disney, like Epcot Center now has this recent thing where basically they pretend you're in a space elevator and then you basically take you to an orbital space station and you dine and it looks like you're in orbit. It's actually pretty well done, to be honest.
It's pretty well, yeah.
Or like a nightclub. Oh, and by the way, I saw somewhere when I was reading up about you that you used to own a nightclub called NASA. So I really would like you to talk about that too.
Yeah, sure. We'll get back to that one. No, I think it is exactly as a blend of all of that. I mean, you know, to make a theme park, a space theme park, is kind of like the easy way to do it. You know, as you say, the Globe in Las Vegas. I was there like a couple of months ago for my birthday, actually, with
the
wife.
Sphere?
Yes, the Sphere, yeah. Sorry, yeah.
The Sphere, yeah.
Yeah, you think about that structure, it holds 18,000 people, up to 24,000 people, actually, in one seating. It's like completely ridiculous. And it's cost $3.5 billion to build it. And it doesn't matter if you occupied all 25,000 seats 10 times a day, they're never going to recoup the money. It's simply impossible for that amount of money. But for the casino industry, it does not matter. What matters to them is that they can get as many people to come as possible, entertain them, and get them to go into the casino and lose all their money. So that's the real business, right? The space industry does not have the same drive. So if you should create something as magnificently crazy as that, it needs to be heavily subsidized by both governments and the industry itself. Otherwise, you can't build it. Because, I mean, you don't want to associate the space industry with a casino, because that's the only kind of money that can build something big enough. Meaning it has to be a business that can sustain itself, right? And I think that's the problem with doing theme parks, is that, you know, you can't do something that is only themed for one thing, because people want more experiences. And then it becomes Disneyfication, where it's everything from Pirates of the Caribbean to a space hotel to, you know, you have to kind of get all your characters in. And it's not about space. It is about the characters, the franchisees that they have in their, parts folder. of characters, right? So it's about a cartoon universe, and space is not a cartoon universe. Space is something that is incredibly important to the humanity and to the future. And that's why it should be taken more serious than a Disneyfication, if you know what I mean. We actually need to do it by space professionals, but also with an entertainment mindset that only people like architects and designers can actually do. If it makes sense what I'm saying, I hope.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So okay, the theme parks, I agree with you, very expensive, very high risk, and really kudos to like Walt Disney, who basically just went through with this vision.
Yeah.
He
actually started by copying the Danish theme park called Tivoli, which is the first theme park in the world in Copenhagen from 1800.
Of course. And for those of our listeners who may not know, that theme park is literally in the middle of the city. I always thought it was a fantastic concept to have a theme park in the middle of a city.
It is smack in the middle of the city. I live next to it, and it's an amazing place. It's a micro Disney World, but it was just before Disney World. And he went here and got inspired and did Disney World, which is, yeah, fabulous. Highly recommended.
So if we kind of, okay, move a little bit down on the ambition scale from theme park to sort of, let's say, resorts, hotels, do you think there's any potential there? There have been some projects, you know, like Disney had the Star Wars hotel, but it was very expensive. Yeah. It was much more on the fantasy side.
Listen, there is a huge potential. The thing is, any space hotel or any association with space and hotel, it has to be in proximity to where space is being worked with, meaning that it has to be, you know, close to launch sites or factories or facilities where you can experience space. So to make like a space themed hotel and put it in the New York City would be completely off the radar. It would be stupid. But if you make one in the Cape Canaveral and you make something that is really special, meaning it's not like you have to sleep in a space shuttle. That's not what I mean when I say space themed. What I mean is that it has to be something where you are giving people hints of space. You know, it has to be sophisticated also, because otherwise it also becomes stupid. It becomes like a, as you say, Star Wars hotel or, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean hotel. It's not where we should go, but something where you are using space technology, you know, in your bedding, you use a circadian lighting system inside, as you would do when you are in space. You would have food offerings that was actually based on space technology, which is quite a lot. There's so many ways where you can use space, and then it has to be a window to rocket launches also. You have to be able to, if it's in Cocoa Beach, to be able to actually see the rocket launches. And it has to be something that is the focal point of why you stay in this facility. That's one thing you could do. And then also it is to do this actually space industry exhibition center. Or we could also call it a theme park, but way more cool than theme park, way more focused on educating the future. Instead of entertaining the future. Because if you only entertain, then you have like a roller coaster that this roller coaster is like a zero G force roller coaster. Like, oh, that's great, you know. But what about, space, how can I say it? Space experiences on Earth, for instance, going deep underwater, you know, which is the closest to being deep in space. But something you can do on Earth. What does it mean? How can you do it? How can you calculate it? How do you create new foods? How do you make a gardens on Mars? You know, all these kind of things that nobody's doing. Everybody's talking about the past or they're talking about the future, but only by entertaining. We need to teach the future generations why space is so incredibly important to humanity. And we don't do it. Big problem.
Yeah, I think we do even have a word for that. It's like bastardized, but it's like edutainment, right? I mean, it's fine to have some fun, right? But you want to combine it with the education. I mean, does any example spring to your mind, like even outside the space sector or like maybe some other sector or activity which has gotten that right, that sort of thing?
Very little. I mean, it's mostly in Colorado Springs, for instance, there is a Olympic Museum there. which is in classic American style, it says the Olympic Museum, meaning that for the world, but actually it is only because there was a Olympic, I think it was, I can't remember the year, but there was actually one year where Colorado Springs was the center of the Olympics, right? And that's why they have an Olympic Museum. But it's very interesting. It always talk about the past, very little about the future. And I think for an experience to be relevant to future generations, it has to kind of open up to the possibilities of a future and also the possibilities of why you should love an industry. And for us, the space industry. That means that you actually have to give them hope for the future and give them the desire to work in the future with something. And you know, if you want, let's say, 8 million people to work in the space industry in 20 years, you better start educating the 5 to 8 year olds right now. And that best way to do it is to make them want to do something. Make them want to not say, I want to be an astronaut, but saying, I want to work with something in this industry because this is fascinating and I can make a difference. And you can only do that by, you know, inviting people into the belly of the industry. You can't do it by saying, oh, the great astronauts and here's a space shuttle and here's a rocket. That doesn't make it. It has to be in, you know, in all the small pockets where there is a reality for anyone to work. From, you know, creating spacesuits to space food to technologies to software, all these things that matters in the big picture. You know, sending a rocket to space is like 100,000 people in the greater scheme of things that works together on creating all the small parts that comes together and make it possible. And that's what we forget sometimes, and it becomes more like about the generals and the leaders and the astronauts. But the industry is big and there's many opportunities for many walks of life to come in and have and make a difference. And that's where we have to aspire.
Exactly. This goes back to our overall sort of point, domesticating the space, domesticating space for everyone. Okay, so we've already talked like theme parks, hotels. You're not getting out of talking about the nightclub, at least for like couple of minutes.
No, of course. I mean, I can tell you the story. So when I was like I sold my first company. I moved away from home when I was 12, so I was pretty young. And I started working in a drum store in Copenhagen. I grew up in a hippie camp, actually, like a commune outside of Copenhagen. And there, when I was 12, I was tired of listening to the grown-ups talking about what they would do tomorrow, but never did, because they were just like smoking cannabis instead and say, yeah, tomorrow, let's do a band. So when I was 12, I was tired and I told my parents that I wanted to move to Copenhagen, and I did. And then I started working in a drum store. And at age 15, I did my first company that was lighting design for festivals and concerts and theater and television and so on. And when I was 19, it was a great company, had 12 employees. I sold it, got my first $1 million, and then I started to do graphic design instead and do, you know, many other kind of designs instead of lighting. And then I stumbled up on a group of people who did nightclubs and they were almost going bankrupt. And then I started working with them on doing scenographies and doing these like monthly themes, including space themes also, including the graphic design, the set design, the lighting design. And it started becoming a good business. And then I was offered to take a 25% share and buy into the company, and I did. And after a year and so on, I thought it would be a great idea to make a super, super VIP nightclub in a space we had available. And I wanted to space theme it because of a Space Odyssey, actually. So we built this completely white nightclub, which is a terrible idea, I can tell you, from operational point of view. You know, strawberry margarita and blue balls, colored drinks, stain everything, and people could smoke cigarettes inside that time. So there was also like cigarette burn marks on the resin floors, and all that was a nightmare. But it meant that we actually banned smoking after 6 months because it was too much of maintaining it, which was also good for people's health. But nevertheless, we made this white nightclub completely inspired by a Space Odyssey, to be honest. And once we talked about the naming, we actually chose the name of NASA. It was very successful. The whole everything was completely in details, from the ashtrays to the uniforms. Everything was white with the NASA logo on. I mean, our own version of the NASA logo, of course, much nicer than the worm logo. And then after like a year of operation, we got first a fax, and then afterwards a recommended letter from NASA in Houston, the legal department, saying that we have done copyright infringement to that brand. And because we went on a couple of front pages in the US for the design of this space. I was like, holy moly, what are we going to do here? So very quickly with our lawyer, who was a very smart guy, he said, well, it sounds like it's more like an acronym, NASA, isn't it? So, and then I was like, sure. Yeah, it could be an acronym. And then we found out that it would be the acronym of Nice and Safe Attitude. And then we made a letter and a fax back to the legal department in Houston and explained that there's a misunderstanding. We said nothing to do with each other. It's basically just an acronym for Nice and Safe Attitude, NASA. And then we never heard anything back, which is incredibly lucky. They probably said like, okay, guys, that's ridiculous, but let's forget about it. It's a nightclub in Copenhagen, you know. So, but nevertheless, and that is interesting also in the design narrative, that nightclub we designed in 1997, it actually didn't close before 2017. So it lasted for 20 years.
That's which very long is for a nightclub.
Very yeah. long for a nightclub. And it remained white all the way through. So it, in many ways, you can say if you design something that is has enough imagination and enough experience power in its you know, delivery to people, then people will come back. And that's what I think is so important about what we do also. So if you do theme parks or you do themed hotels, you can't theme an experience. An experience has to come from within. It has to be something that is deeply rooted in human nature, that when you experience something that gives you goosebumps, that makes it worth to come back, that will renew your experience, that will educate you, then you're onto something right. And that's why space can never be a theme park. Space has to be an experience that educates you, that puts you into the future, that gives you dreams of your own future, if you're a child, for instance. And that's why it's so incredibly important to design something that is, you know, have a deeply rooted in experience, as opposed to just like a theme.
Understood. So, okay, once more, coming back now to our overall theme of the domesticating space and... okay, so unfortunately, we could talk hours about this and we won't have the time, right? I also want to ask you about, you know, just consumer products other than Lego or gaming and stuff like that. But I want to make sure we hit upon one other aspect or one other way of connecting space to everyday people, which is just, for the lack of a better word, generally like the arts, right? Like could be anything, paintings, sculptures, installations. Yes. Any thoughts there, like space and the arts, how can this be connected and made useful to domesticate space?
I think that it is far-fetched, to be honest. I think the arts is the beholder of the eye. Beauty is for the beholder of the eyes, right? So you like some art, I like some other art, and we can probably agree on something and we can disagree about other things. This is good art, this is bad art. So it's really very individual. And that's why I think space is not really to be blended with art. I think space is very much about a future perspective where we have to be much more focused on the experience, because very few people will experience space. To be realistic, I mean, even then they say the space tourism is coming and a space hotel and so on and so on. That's fine, you know, if you have $1 million or $100,000 or how much it is lying around so you can do that experience. Maybe you can come on a list and you can experience it, but it's not for most people. And I think to get it to most people, we need to be not look at it as art, but look at it more as something that is kind of real, where art becomes more like the narrative of an interpretation of something, right?
Yeah,
because
I
it's
just
very real.
realized. Sorry, I just realized it's probably my fault that I prepped the question in the wrong way because I gave these examples of like, just focusing and actually limiting it to, like plastic art, so to say. But art, of course, is much broader. Art is also like, sci-fi novel, like science fiction, like literature, that is art, right?
Yeah,
or
yeah, yeah,
if
yeah.
you go to if you go towards some of the newer media, right? If you have a virtual reality experience, right, and you come up with and design the well, you design the experience, but you also come up with the storyline. I would
Yeah.
also somewhere consider that art. So maybe
That's true.
how about something like that?
No, that I agree to. I mean, to be able to, I mean, I'm a total sucker for science fiction, obviously, I think what I liked about the older science fiction, a Space Odyssey is a good question, is that the production value was incredibly high. You know, think about something that was like filmed and made in 1967, right? Started there and delivered in 1969, without any computerized graphics. You think about that building all that and creating it and making it real to people in a cinematic point of view, that is total art to me, absolutely. Where now you can do so much with both with computer generated arts and also now with AI technology, it is so much faster to create these universes. I mean, it's like super quick. And that means also that we have to look at it in a new perspective. It's easy for people to get access to these kind of computerized experiences, but I think also the experiences that are real, that moves you, that gives you like a physical space, because we are physical human beings. We're not only in our head. And I think when you put on a VR headset or a Apple Vision Pro and so on, which is fantastic, by the way, a bit heavy, if I should say anything, it's really much an experience for your brain, not as much an experience for your body. And I think the big difference about space and VR and Vision Pro experiences is that to create experiences that really is giving you a feeling in your whole body, that's where we want to go. And that's where the future lies in this edutainment, as we're talking about. If you do something, it has to be really immersive, like really in depth. It can't be only for your brain and your eyes and your ears. It has to be something you can feel with your body, so you get the chills of being weightless or getting moved around, or you know what I'm talking about. And that's why I think there is where the link comes. And once it's possible to create a cinematic experience where you actually get moved at the same time, that would be exciting. Then it's more than just entertainment. It can be something that could give you the feel and the chill of actually being in space. That would be awesome. Sure as possible, actually.
So Johannes, we've talked a lot about sort of like this concept of domesticating space in general now, but let's make it more specific and come back to you, Johannes Torpy. Like, what are some of, if you can talk about some of them, what are some of your current sort of space related projects?
Well, it's interesting. I just had a call prior to this with an Indian connection for the space industry that actually also want to kind of connect and tap in on the space industry, because India is a giant country with billion, well, the biggest country in the world right now of population, meaning that the competition for the future and the education is enormous. I mean, so many people that speaks English, which is quite unique to a big country, that can communicate with both every speaking English speaking country in the world, and have a high level of education in many of the certain circumstances. There we have a project that is actually about creating a big experience center, and also both accelerator and what do you call it? Kind of like a center that both gives experiences, but also educates people. And that I think is interesting. And then of course we have our cooperation with the Space Foundation in Colorado Springs, which is super exciting as well, where we have created this big narrative of repurposing their existing structure and making both experience center, but also educational center in Colorado Springs with public access, with a huge roof structure with a view to I wouldn't say Garden of the God because that's on the other height of the hill, but for Pikes Peak. So you have this amazing structure there that is both open to the public, but also have an amazing experience inside the belly of the building. So we are creating these kind of big projects that are really future driven. And then I also have a big interest in doing something in Florida, because I think Florida has enormous potential, both for hospitality experiences, but also for experiences that are, you know, more immersive. And I think finding the right partner there and building something would be a priority for us. So we are working with different people to hopefully find the right setup to do that.
I was going to ask you what sort of your, independent of what you're doing right now, what your sort of dream space related project would be. Would it be that, you know, sort of thing in the experiencing in Florida you're mentioning, or and or
something? Yeah, I would love to do something near Kennedy Space Center. I mean, I would love to be in some way connected with the launch pads, because I think it's there's nothing more unearthly powerful than experience a rocket launch. I mean, you can look at it on TV or on YouTube and so on, but being near and feeling the pressure in the air, feeling the sound in your belly, and the thrill of this happening is just amazing. And I wish more people from the world could get closer to it and actually experience it firsthand. And that would be a great achievement to do that in you know, close to Kennedy Space Center.
Agreed.
Top of the list.
I hope more is going to happen. And so good luck with finding a project there, because I agree that something that, you know, that needs to happen, and maybe more than one.
Sure.
Besides your own projects, any other sort of, and it could be very broad, anything in the sort of realm of domesticating space that you thought is, okay, that's actually well done, other than the Lego we already talked about?
I think there's a lot that's well done, actually. It's, you know, there's a lot of people that works mostly in micro clusters on doing something. I mean, Icon 3D, for instance, is want to 3D print on the moon and have these big robot 3D printers, which is amazing future technology as well, and doing a lot on Earth also, which is a good point of it. But educational wise, I think there is little to none. I mean, it's only like the schools that have a little bit of an access, or you can maybe participate, and a classroom can set a little payload up to space with a poem or a science project and so on. But I think we need to get the future space entrepreneurs and educators much closer to the industry. And I think we are failing at doing it right now. And I really would like to encourage, you know, both the listeners also in the industry to think about solutions for this. And we are very much willing to partake in anything that could create a platform for people to come closer. And I think that would be really a priority of the future, to be honest.
Fantastic. Yeah, and we'll put your website and your and everything in the episode notes as well, so people want to reach out to be able to reach out.
The Golden Spacesuit Talk. That's always good.
Yes, the Golden Spacesuit Talk, absolutely, with the video. Yes, yeah, exactly. As an inspiration. Johannes, as we're unfortunately running out of time here, we'll come to our traditional closing question, which is about science fiction. And we've referenced science fiction so many times already in this talk, specifically 2001, A Space Odyssey. So actually, let me start at 2001 Space Odyssey. So they have this very nice... I don't want to bias you. They have this like orbital space station, right?
Yeah.
The famous scene with the walls and the rocket of the shuttle approaching the sort of rotating orbital space station. What did you think about the design in this movie?
I loved it, because I think in so many ways, when you're weightless, and what is interesting about that space station is that it must be, of course, it's pressurized, but it's a space station where he's running inside. He's running around the whole, you know, circle of that space station. You see the scene where he's running, which is obviously not possible to do in space, possibly. You know, it's kind of working against gravity, right? But it's such an interesting set in that sense, and that the way that it's circular and the spaceship is coming in and in the belly of this structure, and also what I loved a lot about it is that, you know, in some of the opening scenes, he's calling back to Earth through his kids and speaking with his kids on this kind of like FaceTime telephone. And then he's checking into the Hilton Galactica Hotel, sitting in this white universe with a curved around it. And then he's transiting to the next spaceship with stewardesses with white hats and getting like a steak with a straw, you know. All those details that they thought about so early in this cinematic experience and science fiction is just fantastic. And recreating these experiences with this imagination in these days with all the computerized possibilities we have now has not been done ever to that detail again. And I think the devil is in the detail, and I think that's where we have to leave it. And we have to be able to, if we create something, be very detailed. All the small things that you never think people will notice, they will notice, because that makes it greater than the sum of its parts, right? And I think that's what real science fiction is doing. It really gives you like this, like, wow, I could actually be there. It feels real. And that's where I think, you know, the way we create experiences on Earth for space should also be. Yeah. It should feel like being there.
And so besides, so coming that's to important. Our closing question, and maybe you have answered it, but so the closing question is always about favorite sci-fi. So is it 2001 or is it something else? And if you want to make a drum roll to give the answer, you can do that too.
No, I think 2001 is my all-time favorite. I watched that movie, you know, 50 times. It's probably not exaggerating. I even showed it to my little daughter, and it's a question of the details and also the design. I mean, design is very, very important to me, obviously. So it just makes it better, and it's the story is also very psychedelic in many ways. It's like the whole start with the evolution of man and the way it ends. It just has so many elements of greatness that cannot be translated unless you watch it, to be honest. So that is, I would say, is the benchmark for me. Is my favorite.
To design in 2001 as well. Johannes, thank you so much for this very interesting talk about the big theme of domesticated space. And you know, I'm fully aligned with you here. And let's work together to make it happen.
We will work together to make it happen. Looking forward to it. And thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's it for another nominal episode of the Space Business Podcast. If you like this podcast, please consider giving it a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, such as iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter at podcast_space. Also consider supporting us at www.patreon.com/spacebusinesspodcast. If the podcast got you interested in learning more about the business opportunities in the space economy, check out my new online course on space entrepreneurship on udemy.com. The link is in the episode description. Lastly, if you have any feedback, including ideas for guests, and that may include yourself if you have an exciting space story to tell, or interested in being a sponsor, drop us an email at spacebusinesspodcast@gmail.com. I look forward to seeing you for the next episode.